Welcome to the Resilient Performance Podcast, and today I'm joined by Michael Easter. Michael is a contributing editor at Men's Health Magazine and columnist for Outside Magazine. His work also appears in Scientific American, Men's Journal, Women's Health, Cosmopolitan, Vice, New York, and others. He writes about the most important people, places, and things impacting the human experience. He's written features about his badass mom, women fighting their way into elite branches of the military, and the underground anti-aging drug trade. His book, The Comfort Crisis, will be released by Penguin Random House in the spring of 2021. Michael is also a professor in the journalism department at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, UNLV. Before that, he was a senior level editor at Men's Health. Michael lives in Las Vegas on the edge of the desert. Michael, thanks so much for coming on. So in the past, you've been the one asking me all the questions, and now we get to turn the tides a little bit. But I wanted to get you on because I consider you almost like a historian of the health and the fitness space. You've covered a lot of the different trends throughout the years, and it kind of gives you a bird's eye view on the field that even practitioners like me often don't have because we're so in the weeds. So would you mind just starting by talking about how you became inspired to write, and more specifically, to write about health and fitness?
Yeah, for sure. So just for a little background, so I'm a contributing editor at Men's Health. Before that, I was on staff for maybe about a decade. And I got into journalism when I was 13. I read Into Thin Air. So this is like nonfiction book about adventure, and it like blends. It's got like a lot of health information, a lot of science information. And I loved it. I didn't realize I could do that for a living until I was like in college. So I ended up going to grad school, studied journalism, health journalism specifically. And while I was in grad school, I ended up interning at Esquire magazine. So definitely like a dude's magazine, more or less. And then I also ended up interning at Scientific American. And so on one hand, I had experience with sort of like men's magazines. And I also had this experience with science magazines, and a job opened up at Men's Health. And so I applied, and it kind of made sense, right? Because Men's Health is like, it's got health and men's stuff more or less. So I was a good fit. And in terms of health and fitness stuff, like I was definitely interested in it, but not like obsessive about it. You know, probably in high school, I started working out. I'd played a few sports, wasn't that great at them, you know, like I would get injured. I was decent at basketball, but my ankles just would not let me play with any consistency. And so I just started training in the gym. I always liked it. I was like terrible at training. Like I remember in college, the people who were into sports would come up and be like, dude, you really shouldn't round your back like that when you're lifting, you know? but I had the interest level. You know, so when I had the interview at Men's Health, he was like, well, you know, you definitely know how to write. We got your writing samples. We think your chops are good. But how do you feel about writing about fitness? And I was like, well, I like to work out. You know, I definitely work out. And the guy who hired me was like, okay, good enough. Because in his mind, you know, he said it's easier to take a natural writer and reporter and teach them about the basics of fitness rather than take someone who's like super in the weeds in fitness and try to teach them how to write. They've tried it both ways, he said, and it just works better this way. So yeah, I ended up getting a job there, and their office was actually in Pennsylvania. So I moved from New York, lived in Pennsylvania for a while. And I just got thrown into the world of talking to people like you, talking to people like Bill Hartman, like all the sort of, you know, big name, quote unquote, big names you hear in fitness, which, you know, the average person doesn't know. But if you're in the fitness world, these are like big, you know, big people, sort of famous people in the fitness world. And I would have to take what they told me and translate it into something actionable for, I think we had like 3 million subscribers at the time, and stuff would oftentimes get pushed over to our international editions. So the reach was like, I think something like 30 million people, you know? So it's been an interesting ride, especially, you know, with getting to meet and talk to people who are sort of on the ground in fitness every single day, working with real people, but who are also like inherently really into the nuances, you know, and trying to take that and translate it to, you know, Joe, who just wants to like do a quick workout on his way home from work, doesn't really care about fitness, just doesn't want to be fat, and also like wants to look halfway decent with a shirt off and also just feel better and be able to do stuff with his kids, you know? So it's definitely been an interesting gig so far, I'll say.
Yeah. And one thing that I appreciated about you was that you actually, you wanted that nuance and you weren't looking just to generate like clicks and headlines, which is kind of, you know, in the internet and social media era, what's sort of incentivized. You were legitimately curious and like wanted to have that nuanced message, which can be hard with the limitations that you work under in terms of like, you know, characters you're allotted and stuff like that. But I'm sure that you have some cool stories. And so without getting into your most recent trip and the book project that you're working on, because I think that's a little bit separate from your fitness endeavors, just as you know, there's a lot of personalities in the health and fitness field. And you've had the opportunity when these people have been relevant or these trends have been relevant to interview and write about a lot of these subjects. So what are some of the more interesting stories and experiences that you've had as they pertain to health and fitness over the last like decade or so that you've been doing this?
Yeah, man. I mean, so I got into writing, like I said, you know, I read Into Thin Air and I was like, oh, you can do really cool stuff and then just write about it. And like, that's your job, you know? So I sort of took that realization and tried to translate it into what I did at Men's Health. So I kind of became a person who would, a type of reporter who would go out in the world and try and find interesting people doing interesting things and like changing things for the average person. So a few stories, like one time I trained with the first guy to ever bench press 1,000 pounds. So I was like 24 years old. I've never been that strong. And like, he gives me this address to this gym and I like roll up and it's literally a shed in the middle of the woods in Pennsylvania. I open the door. There's like three pit bulls that descend on me. And all these dudes are like 300 pounds, huge, wearing their bench shirts. There's death metal playing. And it's like, okay, I'm going to hang out with these dudes for like 3 days a week for the next like 3 months, you know,
really? It was that long.
Yeah. And I stuck out like a sore thumb, you know, like, obviously listeners can't see me, but I'm like 6 foot tall, kind of skinny, you know, just like a basic dude. And here are these just like absolute monsters who are like squatting a grand. And they're like, okay, now we got to strip all the plates off because Mike Leister is going to try and squat 200 pounds, you know? So yeah. It's just funny stuff like that. You know, I've been able to train with and just hang out with a lot of the pretty high up CrossFit guys and some of the women. And those people are just absolute freaks. Just being able to see them actually go and like move the weight they do, it's just like, holy crap. It's unbelievable.
How much time are those people devoting to training every day?
That's a good question. I mean, I think they more or less live it. I think they'll do like 3 days. But it's, you know, it's 24/7. It's,
yeah.
You know, if they're not training, they're trying to do recovery stuff. They're prepping their meals, they're doing whatever. And, you know, I was covering, especially early on when a lot of them, like you could own a gym and try and run it and also be like pretty highly ranked, go to the games. And now I think even more so it's a professional sport, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like I used to cover the Olympics quite a bit. So stuff with a lot of the Winter Olympians was really cool. Like I'd go up to Lake Placid quite a bit. And those guys are really interesting because they're just absolute freaks at what they do, but there's also not a lot of money in it, right?
Yeah.
So, like, and some of them would be in sports where they're probably not going to win. You know, if you just look at like the Nordic sports, for example.
Yeah.
Those people are absolute freaks, but like if you just look at the record, we rarely medal in those, and people have just devoted their lives living at the Olympic Training Center, trying to like push that, you know? So it's kind of this interesting dichotomy of like, I guess it was just interesting to see people who dedicated themselves so heavily into something that, I don't know, you're probably not going to win and you're not going to make any money off it. but they love
it. Which is like admirable in many ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so like for me initially, it was kind of just like, what are you guys doing? You know, but then you see that and they're like, well, we just love this process. And it's like, oh, okay. I can get that. That's
you were that kind. Like you asked them like, hey, you know, even acknowledging that there's a low probability that you're going to medal and you're in a sport that's not very lucrative. Like you were comfortable asking that and they gave you a pretty candid answer. And it came down to the process and just wanting, like enjoying that journey.
Yeah, exactly. They just love doing what they do. And you know, they live in Lake Placid. They live in what is essentially a college dorm with a lot of like-minded people. So like, I could see how it would be awesome, you know?
Yeah, like what's the alternative? Like having a regular job, you know?
Exactly. Now they have to like, when they get out of that world, sort of age out, they're going to have to start, you know, they're essentially 35 years old, but their resume says they're 21.
Yeah.
That might be kind of tough, but you know, I don't know. Yeah. I'm sure they'll
look back on it. Olympic pedigree on the resume isn't bad either. It makes you pretty unique.
Yeah.
That's looking cool. Real quick, going back to when you went to Pennsylvania for like 3 months, was that just for one story? Cause it's pretty intense to like live and train amongst people like that for 3 months, just for like, was it one article or was it like a book project? What was that project?
It was one article. And so this was back in the day too, when there was a little more money publications had a lot more money to devote to stories like that. So the gym was actually maybe a 45-minute drive from the men's health office, luckily.
Okay.
So I'd just drive down, you know, a few times a week, hang out with them. Like training sessions would be like 3 hours. And I would maybe do like 5 sets, 10 sets the whole time. Just these long rest breaks and then accessory work. And but really just kind of observing and hanging out. And then at the end of that, I competed in a powerlifting meet, which was...
Oh, cool.
Equally funny because the guys at the gym, they kind of realized what the deal was. They were like, yeah, he's doing it for a story. That's why he doesn't fit in. But everyone watching me lift at the meet in my singlet are just like, what is this kid doing? You know?
Did you get a lot stronger, at least like relative to what you were?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I still would say I was pretty weak, but I was less weak, I guess I would put it.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, I guess they were good sports, you know, for...
Yeah, for sure. I'm trying to think of some other places. So I trained at Jim Jones for a while. That was really interesting. That was kind of a
legendary place.
Yeah, legendary place. And when I was there, I feel like it was kind of at its apex. And just, you know, you go to like a seminar or something and there would be like 30 people and they'd get these crazy group competitive workouts going, and just like the intensity in there is like unlike anything I've ever experienced. And also it was a place that like the hardest I've ever trained was in there, and like they were able to sort of get performance out of people that you would have no idea you could ever do. So just like finding some cool little scenes like that, I think was really the perk of the job, and just getting to meet interesting people, you know.
Did you get to meet Mark Twight when you were out there?
I did, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he's definitely a legend in the training world. So,
because a lot of people, you know, who aren't familiar with climbing associate him with training, but he is an elite world class alpinist, and the stuff that, I mean, technically and physically he does on a mountain, like, I mean, books have been written about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to actually like read some of his climbing related books, because I think he discovered a lot of really insightful things about training before he was quote unquote like training other people, because he had to be physically very competent to do the things that he did on the mountain. And he was very systematic in his preparation, but it was cool to see him kind of translate that into something that's a little bit more that like regular people could do, you know, in a gym setting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, he's definitely a freak mountaineer. That's for sure. Like he has some ascents that I don't think anyone has done since.
Yeah.
And because of who he was, you got a lot of really interesting people in the gym who were trying to, you know, push their physical limits there, because it would translate when they're trying to do some climb that is exceedingly dangerous, you know,
yeah,
or something like that, or like ski mountaineering. They had a lot of ultra runners, and this was before, I mean, I guess ultra running still isn't super popular, but when it was kind of like this obscure, like, what the hell are those people doing type sport, you know? So interesting place for sure.
So having had these like experiences, the field can be just sort of like trendy and overreaction, underreaction. There's always kind of like, what's the fad? And I'm not saying that the experiences you're referencing are faddish at all, because if anything, those are the pinnacles of various sub-disciplines within the field. And so those are kind of like, that's the good, right? Having seen like how the pendulum can swing from thing to thing, in your experience with like the better, more competent providers, like what do you see as the trends that are the principles that sort of unite these various places when it comes to training, health, fitness? Like what are sort of the universal pillars that like regardless of who you work with or who you covered, where you're like, these are the things that make them good, and they're somewhat transferable to other realms within the fitness space?
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the answer you're looking for, but I do feel like the people who I consistently go back to are people who realize like the limitations of their knowledge. Hmm. Like they'll, you know, and they fuse what you might find in the textbook with what they found works in practice. And, but they'll also give you a strong opinion. So like a lot of, this is probably not a great example, but a lot of like people who only work in a lab, you might talk to them about their research and they'll be like, well, I can't tell you anything, whether you should do X or Y or Z. And I get that, but that's not really useful then, right? It's like, okay, well then why are you studying this exercise then? Like what can we take away from that? And then on the other side of that, there's people who are like very set in their ways. Like, you know, you just have to be strong. That's all you need. Like 100%. And it's kind of like, are you sure? You know, like, are you sure about that? Because, you know, the tides always turn in fitness. It's like 1 year something's hot and the next it's like, now we're onto this other idea. And oh, that was dumb. And blah, blah. So it's like, why do people not assume that that could be the case with what they so firmly believe now? So I think the best people, and this is why we're friends, because I can call you up and be like, I have this question. And you're like, well, here are a couple different ways to look at it. Here's what so-and-so might say. Here's what so-and-so might say. Here's what I do. And I'm going to tell you why. And you'll tell me why. And you're like, that's just what I do. That doesn't mean I'm absolutely right. But like, because you take that approach instead of something so absolutist, I'm like, okay, that seems reasonable to me, you know?
Yeah, and what's also interesting is that, I mean, you're writing for a general readership, people, many of whom aren't that passionate about fitness, but they recognize that it's important and they want to do something, whether it's for longevity or to enjoy the sports they play, the hobbies that they want to pursue. So how do you, as a writer, you know, you might interview someone who's like a specialist in the field, but mm-hmm. if you write in a way that's very, very specialized, you're going to lose your readership because they don't necessarily care. Like they're never going to be able to bench press 1,000 pounds. Right. So how do you translate what some of these like very, very legitimate high level coaches are doing in these very specific areas of fitness and then translate that into something that's actionable for a regular person?
Yeah.
Well, it's like a dot connector, you know, in many ways.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that who I would consider the better ones will be like, okay, I trained this NFL player. Here's what we do. But here's how I would translate that to, you know, Joe, whoever it is, you know, let's back off on the reps. Let's also do this. And they're able to think about, okay, if I had an average person doing this, here's what I would do. And oftentimes that comes from me, right? Because I'll be like, this is great. But you know, this, whatever the workout is, say it's some, I don't know, something where they have like predetermined weights or something, like, you know, I don't know if our readers can lift this much weight. Like, how would you scale this back? Or what would you do with this if just some random guy walked into your gym and you had no idea about his training history and what he could do? Like, how would you write this in that case, you know? And the best ones will, and the ones who absolutely don't bend, I'll usually run it past someone who we trust. You know, you get trusted people and like, is this going to kill someone? You know, and if the answer is yes, then we just don't run it. You know, we don't have like, I'm not putting out information that other people think is going to hurt someone, you know?
Yeah. One thing I've noticed just from like reading some of your, your work is that, like, regardless of who you're writing about, one of the overarching themes seems to be just consistency. People, like, they have a system that they trust, and they're also transparent about, like, this is what it's for, right? So obviously, like, the person that's trying to bench press 1,000 pounds, they're not saying that what they're doing necessarily translates to, like, the general population. Like, they've got a very specific goal, and they're not trying to say that, like, their system is the best thing for a 50-year-old male or female that just wants to, like, be able to lift their arms over their head without shoulder pain necessarily. But it seems like, regardless of, you know, what the subspecialty is, these people are very, very diligent, methodical, and, like, highly consistent. Would you say, like, that's kind of what you've observed?
Yeah, I think so. It's just, like, realizing, it's understanding the audience, right? And, like, being able to adapt that and not say that everyone, realizing that people are individual, more or less.
So having seen all those things and, like, you know, trying to connect all these dots, for, like, the average person who's not going to be an elite athlete that is interested in just longevity, feeling good, and then being, you know, athletic enough to do active hobbies, like, say that they enjoy skiing on the weekends or playing golf or playing pickup basketball, where fitness is more of a means to an end than, like, they're not competing in fitness, like a CrossFit Games competitor. Like, what general recommendations do you think are kind of the safe things to say? Like, these are the things that you, without getting into, like, the details, more just, like, the key points, like, what are the things that people should be doing to just maintain overall health, wellness, longevity, and, like, a baseline level of athleticism? So I think you even wrote, like, an article about, you know, just different, like, tests and measures that you think are indicative of wellness at any age.
Yeah. Well, that's where I ask you. You're the expert, man. I'm not the expert. But if,
so you get to talk to a lot more people, though, than me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to be clear, like, I'm not an expert. But if you had to ask me, I would say that generally not doing one thing at the expense of all others is good. Like, so you should probably be doing some strength stuff. You should probably be doing some endurance stuff. You should probably be focusing on movement, and you should probably also be doing other stuff beyond health, you know, beyond stuff you can do in the gym or outside, eating well, also just getting outside and doing stuff. I mean, like, it's hilarious to me because people always crap all over the government guidelines for things like physical activity and things like nutrition. But, like, if people actually did them, they'd probably be a lot healthier, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just basic stuff. And I think sometimes what happens is when people become interested in fitness at sort of try and go a little deeper, they start to latch on to, like, they start to become a little too, I guess, married to one set of ideals and think that it's the best at the expense of all others. When it's like, you should probably be doing a few different things and experimenting and sort of finding what seems to work for you, you know, because it's like, do we have any data that says, like, oh, the person who did this workout lived longer than the other? It's like, no. You don't know any of that stuff, right? So, like, you see a lot of kind of wild claims, I guess, in the fitness world sometimes that I don't know if we can really back them up or ever know them.
Yeah, but and part of the reason why I'm asking you is because you're not in the field, and I think sometimes, like, we can drink a little bit of our own Kool-Aid too much, and that's why, like, having somebody outside the field can provide a perspective and almost like a sanity check. So that's actually why I'm asking you. But it just seems like, so from a health, longevity, and wellness standpoint, you're saying kind of do a little bit of everything and don't overly chase specialization, because, you know, you can't do one thing without robbing yourself of other things, sort of. And then that leaves, which is encouraging, because that leaves a lot of room for choice. Like, there's a lot of ways that can work. It's not dogmatic.
Yeah, exactly. And this might be slightly off topic, but this made me think of something too, is like, you often see things framed in fitness. Like, if you do this, you're going to lose all your gains. If you do this, you're definitely going to get hurt.
Right.
Like, something that you always say to me is, like, humans are very resilient and robust. Like, you're not going to die if you do one, like, if you lose your form a little bit on this exercise or do X or Y or Z, right? Might even be good for you. So I think just, like, exposing yourself to a lot of different variables is pretty good for the average person.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, a lot of that is people take research out of context. Like they'll look at a study that says stretching makes you weaker.
Yeah.
And it's like, but if you look at the actual study, it's, well, they stretch the same muscle for 5 minutes straight, which like nobody actually does. And then they immediately did a power test where there was like some statistically significant loss in power. But in real life, like someone's going to stretch, they're going to do a lot less than 5 minutes. Then they're going to do a dynamic warm up and they're going to like warm up. If it's basketball, they'll do a shoot around or they'll work on some skills. So whatever transient loss in power occurred, like they'll get that back. But the flip side is, so people take that out of context and like, wow, I should like never stretch at all. And then it's like, all right, so now your body has no bandwidth for movement because, you know, you don't put your joints in positions beyond what you would encounter in your daily life. So you have no kind of buffer. And like we get into the semantics of, well, is it static stretching or is it dynamic stretching? And to me, it's like, just put your body in positions that you don't encounter during your day to day so that when you play a sport or whatever, you're not operating at 100% of what your positional capacity is. And I think we just get so caught up sometimes in like the semantics and like, well, I can't static stretch because I'm going to lose power. And it's like, that's not really what the study says. If you look at the full context of it.
Yeah. And I think the problem is that, you know, part of it is my industry is that, like, you know, a journalist reads a study and thinks it says one thing and they write about it. And oftentimes they will talk to the researcher and there's incentives for researchers to be covered in the press, you know? So maybe they blow it out too. It's kind of like a two-way street, but then things get taken to their logical extreme, right? It's like one study came out that says X, like a good example would be, this isn't fitness related, but you know, when the research started to suggest that maybe saturated fat wasn't as bad as we thought it was, it's like people go, oh, great. Well, I'm going to put a stick of butter in my coffee every morning.
Yeah, 100%.
And then there's, you know, there's tons of examples from fitness with that too, where it's like, one I remember was this argument, and I don't know if it was based off specific research, probably came out of the early HIT research, but you know, people were like saying that jogging would make you fat.
Like, that's the obesity epidemic could be attributed to jogging too much.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, where it's like, you know, like, what are you talking about? And this was something that you saw said by like a lot of people, just sort of caught on as this argument. And like, you know, one blogger picks up the idea, rolls with it, and it just sort of spreads. And it's like, what the hell are we talking about? Like, humans have been running for millions of years. It's not the place of a bro behind a keyboard to try and change that, you know? Like, come on.
The biggest thing is like, if you enjoy running, then you should do it, you know? Like, body composition is one variable. Like, you know, ultimately people should do what they enjoy. And as long as they're safe and healthy and not infringing on other people, then like, what is it? Who are we to say like, you shouldn't run? But yeah, it's interesting because things get like, I remember even with the Tabata study, which is referenced a lot, it is like proof that interval training is superior to everything else. Cause I was talking to somebody about this actually, like right before we got on this call. In that study, you know, they do that Tabata protocol where it's like 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, 8 times, a couple days a week. But what people often neglect to mention is, I think 2 days a week, the experimental group in that study did like a half hour to 45 minutes of just slow, steady aerobic work.
Yeah.
And so it was basically Tabata plus aerobic work was one group, and the other group was pure aerobic work. And Tabata won, and people say, well, therefore you shouldn't do any like low intensity aerobic work. But that was actually part of the protocol that was deemed to be successful. But people just like, because they want to make it polarizing either or, then it's like, well, all you've got to do is the Tabata protocol. But even in that study, the experimental group did more than the Tabata protocol.
Right. Right. And can people do what was actually in any given study? Like, I think one thing with that, so I could be mixing up studies, but one thing is they hit just like, to dumb this down, they went super, super hard. And it's like, is the average person going to get to that level where they're like tasting blood in the gym? It's like, no, probably not.
Right.
Like, how do you do that at like a Gold's Gym without getting kicked out? You know, like they don't even have the right equipment for it.
Yeah. I mean, to do some of those, like those really short interval protocols and get the benefit, it takes a certain psychological makeup, you know, where you're really maximizing every second of output. And if you're not doing that, then you're doing aerobic work on the clock, you know, on an interval time frame.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, I mean, you mentioned the researchers. Like, I've actually found that the researchers are often the most intellectually honest about the limitations, and they'll even write in their papers like, these were the results in a very confined set of circumstances. It's not generalizable until we can do X, Y, and Z. It's other people who are looking for like the answer who take the research out of context. So that's when, you know, it's a world of incomplete information, and we need research. Yeah. We also need like honest people to interpret the research and generalize it, and not, because it's become very political. Yeah. I think a lot of the research, and people are in their tribes, and they're going to cherry pick. If they love intervals, they're going to find a study that proves that you don't need to do anything else. But then if you look at like even elite endurance athletes, they're doing a mix. They're always doing a mix of higher and lower intensity work. And the proportion of it might vary depending on someone's like style, but no one's doing like one versus the other in, you know, in isolation.
Yeah, I agree. So, I agree. It's mainly driven by loud voices on the internet, more or less, these debates, where if you really back up, it's like the debate is just amplified by people who have a platform, more or less. Yeah. And I do think sometimes, though, you know, from my experience talking to researchers, I agree with you that that's the case, but you'll also find that they may talk to you for like 20 minutes about how great this is, and then the last like 2 minutes, it might be like, oh, by the way, this isn't generalizable, you know? And so it's
like a commercial for a medication where it's like, this is going to change your life. And then the last 30 seconds is, and this can cause blindness and premature death. And, you know, yeah.
You may die. So I do think, I mean, especially for, I mean, the economics of journalism have changed a lot. And you're having a lot of younger reporters having to crank out a lot of stories in a day. So it's definitely hard to get that nuance in when you have to write the story in like 2 hours, you know, and really pick up on some of those nuances. So I don't think that helps either. And I think that, I don't know, it's definitely complicated, you know, how to get the right information out. I mean, there's definitely some people who are doing it, but those stories tend to take a little more time.
Yeah. I mean, the incentives aren't always there. Like, do you feel like, whether it's in your own space or like in different aspects of journalism, it's not as interesting necessarily. Well, it's interesting, but it's not as catchy to say, like, to write a nuanced article, the gist of which is, well, it depends, which is usually the answer to most questions.
Yeah.
But if you're limited to a certain number of characters on Twitter, the clickbait headline is like going to get more views than something that's more nuanced. So is there pressure to kind of dilute the message? Are you seeing that at all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and it starts really with the headline, you know, because the way that online publications make money is through clicks, getting eyes on the advertisers, attention, right? It's an attention economy. And if you run a headline that's like, I don't know, HIT is maybe good for whatever, it's like, no one's buying that, you know, but if it's like, you study HIT, blah, 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 people are like, click. So even if you have the nuance in there, that sometimes gets lost even by the headline. So I think you need to add it, but I also get it from the point of view of
me. I totally get it. I mean, it's a business. Like, you have to make money and you're vying for attention. And right now, like, attention is the currency of our time, and nuance is not conducive to generating attention.
Yeah.
So I see it from both sides. It's really hard.
Definitely. And then at the same time, you know, most Americans aren't moving enough. So like, if they think that HIT is going to do whatever, whatever, go for it, you know?
And that's the thing. And that's where, like, I used to get hung up on, you know, people in the field, like, are obsessed with perfection. Right. But when you work with humans, perfection is usually not an option.
Right.
And for a lot of people, like, especially if they believe something is like the answer, and they're ultimately, it's going to be, they're going to do that one thing that might be a little bit faddish, or they're not going to move at all, then 100% it's a victory if they're doing the faddish thing, right? And people often get mad, like, there's certain, you know, whatever, like, classes or systems where, you know, maybe they're not as substantive from like the technical standpoint, but there's a lot of like camaraderie and a lot of energy and stuff like that. And that's almost, people look down on that in the field, but it's like, that's getting people to exercise, which is generally a good thing. So as long as they're like relatively safe and not endangering themselves, maybe they're not doing what you learned in the textbook in like a strength and conditioning certification, but we're not dealing with professional athletes. We're dealing with like regular people who otherwise are not passionate about movement and exercise. And there's a health epidemic and obesity epidemic. And so, you know, you got to look at the totality of it too, right? And it's about the whole experience and not just like what looks best on paper or in a research study.
Right. So, right. And it's, you know, it's like, the classic example is CrossFit. It's like, especially when that was first growing, it was like so much hate about it because of this question about, you know, injury rates and whatnot. But the loudest voices were often people, in the fitness world who like train football players. It's like, if you really cared about human health, like you're making missiles that are smashing into each other every Sunday. Like, do you really care? You know, like,
right, right.
That. So it's, I don't know. It's just convoluted. And I think at the end of the day, it's like, how can we get more people to find something they enjoy doing, that's physical, that helps their health. And, that's sort of the answer. Of course, there's always optimal, but we know people don't always find optimal, you know?
Right. And it's so, even optimal is like context dependent, right? Depending on what someone's goals are. And do you anticipate any future trends or new things, or because it seems like old things constantly resurface and are repackaged under different names and nothing is that new. Do you, based on what you've seen, is anything really new on the horizon, or is it just kind of more the same, but more just like repackaging the same things?
That's a good question. I mean, you definitely see a trend where something becomes, you know, the hot new thing, and then all of a sudden, no, it actually sucks, you know?
Like, yeah.
Where it's like, I mean, you're kind of seeing that now with a lot of the movement stuff. I am, at least, where, you know, there's been a lot of great strides made in helping people move better, but now you have trainers who are sort of loudly proclaiming, like, I don't have people do any warm-up drills. That shit just waste time or whatever. And
right.
In terms of new stuff, like, actually new, I think it'll be, I mean, I definitely have some skepticism about, like, wearable technologies.
I was going to ask you about tech and, like, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do think it's getting a lot better, though. And, you know, specifically, like I talked to, for example, just today, I talked to this guy who is a researcher at UCSD, and he's using data from the Oura Ring. He has a study going to potentially predict COVID. And obviously there's a lot of like, the data is still waiting to come in, but there's like a little bit of promise there, especially as the tech becomes better. Like, can we use these things to like really integrate and change behaviors and like learn things about public health that we would have otherwise known? Like that feels pretty new to me. You know, anything with AI and machine learning, I think there's a huge opportunity right now. It's just applying it appropriately and also realizing that there's limitations. Cause like the guy I talked to today, he's like, humans are insanely complex. Like, you know, don't get the wrong idea that all of a sudden this is going to like save us all. Cause it's not. And we have a ton to learn, but we also have these technologies we've never had before that are really good at learning. So we don't know what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah. It's always like perpetual promise with it, but then the details can, time will reveal it, I guess, you know, yeah. But it was cool that he acknowledged that there still is a lot of ambiguity with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know. What's your take on that stuff with your clients? I'd be interested to hear.
I think that if for some people, like the technology holds them accountable. Mm-hmm. So like personally, I'm going to do the same thing, whether, I've got like a watch or an app telling me to exercise today, mm-hmm. because it's just like, it's a part of my life and it's I've already created my own habits. If the technology helps to create good habits, then I'm all for it. Cause if someone's like, you know, generally doesn't move that much, and like 10,000 steps is probably an arbitrary number, but if people who otherwise like aren't going to do that much, like, and it would sit inside all day, are going to go out and try to get 10,000 steps. And the alternative is really nothing else. I think that's great. So as long as people don't become like slaves to the metrics and the quantification, where now it's not about so much like what they're actually doing, but it's about chasing the number, because that can be problematic. And Adam Alter wrote a really good book about kind of like tech addiction and how, you know, it's the metric itself can become the driver for the dopamine response and lead to almost like pathological and addictive behavior. And then you're forgetting about you're trying to do something healthy. And you know, a lot of the tech things, especially like the minimally invasive ones, are promising to do something that really to be done with validity and reliability, you need a very expensive, large machine for, or even an invasive test. So they haven't really been validated against like a gold standard. But that said, like if you're using like a heart rate variability technology, even if it's consistently somewhat unreliable and inaccurate, if it's using the same algorithm, at least you can see some trends.
Yeah.
So, and if those trends, I mean, you use the key word, I think it's behavior. If those trends and that data leads to positive behavioral adaptations on a micro or a macro level, I think it's good. There's obviously some ethical issues with large data sets and who owns that,
right.
And how to protect it and protect people's privacy. But assuming those things can be done, I think that we have to look into it. But I think ultimately it comes down to behavioral change. And if the tech can be a driver for that in a healthy way, not in an addictive or pathological way, then I think it's good. I think it's to each their own. I give people the choice. And if they're like really excited about it, like, I don't want to tell them that, oh, like, I don't think you should use it, because again, I'm looking at the totality. And if in totality that tech is leading to a positive behavior, then I'm very supportive of it.
Yeah, like I know a handful of people who it's helped them identify behaviors that weren't great, you know, like, I don't know, sleep monitor showing that, you know, on nights that a person had a drink or two before bed, like, oh, their sleep was shitty and they kind of felt not great the morning before. Like, do you need a $300 wristwatch to tell you that might be happening? I don't know, but some people do.
Yeah, know? Some people might. I mean, again, everyone knows that sleep is really good for you, but maybe the accountability of, oh, like, even if they can't quantify, I think quantifying sleep quality to me is a little bit, can be suspect with like something that's worn around you. Like, how are they really measuring that? But even duration, like if you're, you know, if your watch or your phone recognizes that like you're moving relatively stationary. Yeah. So even if you're not like getting deep sleep for those 8 hours, at least like you're in bed. If that data leads people to like get to bed earlier and at least like make the effort to try to sleep 8+ hours a night, then it's good. I mean, because I think with a lot of things, it's not like lack of information. It's applying the information we already know and doing the easy things well. And sometimes tech can be a means to make that happen. So
yeah, you said, I agree. Yeah, I think there's also a trend too of like people just like, I think it's driven by social media, but just trying to be the dude who did the hardest thing ever. And it's sort of like this, you know,
right.
Measuring stick keeps getting pushed back. I mean, my sense is you might see some pushback on that soon, because I don't know how sustainable that is.
Yeah.
Trying to think what else comes to mind. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be.
I think tech is probably that to me is the most intriguing area, because like I don't think fitness and the way that you can manipulate workouts and physical activity can really change that much. But I think how that's delivered technologically is probably, you know, that's where there's a lot of. It's going to be exciting to see where it goes for better or for worse.
And I mean, I do hope that too, we don't get so techie that like everyone's working out behind screens, you know,
in years.
Cause I mean, I think that there's huge benefits of being outdoors that a lot of people miss when they're only training in a gym.
Yeah.
And there's this one scientist, I think he's at USC now, but he's done some work where he looks at, I have to remember exactly what it is, but essentially he's a neurologist, and he sort of compares what happens in the brain when people train outside versus like being on a treadmill watching a screen.
Right.
And there's definitely some differences there. And, you know, he's a anthropologist by training, and his argument is like, you know, when we evolved and we're exercising, which was really just life then, it's like we had to like navigate terrain. You know, something like a persistence hunt is as much of a mental exercise as it is a physical one.
Yeah.
Now we really only get the physical part. You know, we're not training our brain at the same time. So it'll be interesting to see like what that leads to. Hopefully more people get outside. I don't think that's ever a bad idea personally. But
Yeah, and it's now obviously because of the COVID thing, there's a reluctance to be around other people, but I think there's a benefit to the social aspect of exercising in a group or being outside in a group. And, you know, there's obviously things that we have to respect about this virus, but the downside to like isolation, you know, even though a lot of stuff is hard to quantify, can be as catastrophic on a macro level as what can be done from the virus. And it's like, how do we balance those two things, the respect for the way that things can spread very quickly from a disease standpoint to like, all right, but if we're just going to be like, hey, we don't have enough information, we're just going to remain kind of paralyzed forever. That also has second order effects too. So none of this stuff is easy, but like you said, going back to training, there's no free rides anywhere. If you do too much of one thing, it's going to take away. But since you brought up being outside and kind of the benefits of like, you know, tracking and thinking, I think that's a good segue into the book that you just finished.
Yeah.
So can you get into that book project and what you did? Because that's a really cool story that combines fitness with adventure and really like coming out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, for sure. So I got the backup, the idea of this book is like, I wanted to look at how the world has become so comfortable. So if you think about it, like in the last 100 years, like the things that most affect a human's day-to-day experience, they're all like 100 years or less, right? They're not old. Like our cell phones, that's new. We spend like 4 hours on them a day. Temperature control. We don't really have to put in physical effort for anything anymore. Our food system, like we don't have to work for food. We're just surrounded in comfort food. And so like playing off this idea of what have been the effects of all this comfort we live in, it kind of looks at the health effects of that. And then also what are ways we can insert this idea of discomfort into our lives, but interpret it through a handful of different ways. So things like hunger, things like how should we think about training, you know, things even like we don't experience death anymore, right? It's like when people die now with the modern funeral system, they basically like die in a hospital, go to a mortician, we make them look as youthful as possible, then we send them into the ground, you know, whereas like death used to be this thing that people experience not only with their loved ones, but also things like with the food system, like you killed your own food more or less. So I did this long trip. I was in Alaska for 30 some odd days, and we were in the Arctic for most of the time on this backcountry hunt. So that was sort of a way to try to, you know, kind of a contrived way to experience a lot of these discomforts that humans used to face all the time. You know, we're out having to put in physical effort every single day to get from point A to point B. There obviously wasn't temperature control. Like everything we did out there took effort. And, even the act of, I ended up, killing a caribou, and like, I'd never killed anything beyond a bow.
With a bow and arrow, correct?
With a rifle.
Okay. Okay. So Donnie was the bow and arrow, right?
Yeah. And he even used a rifle on the caribou hunt. He usually does, bow and arrow stuff, but he rifled that trip. And just like that act alone is like, it's really interesting because afterwards I was kind of an emotional, like a little bit of a mess, you know, I just felt kind of really heavy. And then you have this realization as you're breaking the thing down, it looks like meat. And like, why don't I feel this way when I eat meat normally, you know? So sort of trying to get back to some of these things we had to deal with in the past in a lot of different ways. And looking at how we've changed and how like our comfortable world has changed us is more or less what the book's about. And I did a lot of other traveling on each of the topics. So now I went to Bhutan for about a week or two, and I went to Iceland for a little while and a bunch of different pockets around the country to sort of meet with different people who are sort of thinking about discomfort in different ways and what it can do for us more or less.
When you were on that Alaska trip, how long did you go without sleeping in a bed?
Oh, weeks. So we did, let me hear and plug in here. We were 2.5 weeks in the Arctic, and then we did 2 weeks in the Chugach Mountains on a doll sheep hunt. So, the Chugach are outside of Anchorage, so they're pretty, they just kind of shoot out of the shoot out of the sea, more or less, a lot of ups and downs. We packed everything in. The Arctic is not, the landscape isn't as extreme, but it's just, it's huge and it's haunting, and it can get, the weather can get pretty gnarly up there. We were just living out of tents and a teepee the whole time. So it was definitely an adventure. Physically, it was just fascinating to me that, you know, you, Doug, wrote me a program for it. And like, I went into that trip fitter than I've ever been in my life. And when I got out there, I was definitely prepared, but I don't think you can ever prepare for certain types of landscapes.
Yes. You
know? Like, that's just this variable that you can never control. So for example, like the Arctic tundra, it's, I would describe it as a mattress that is covered in half inflated basketballs. So it's like there's like these really soft areas, but then there's these things called tundra tussocks all over it, like just pimples all over it that are these like round, sort of soft pieces of grass. So you can never, like, it just sucks to walk on. It just sucks. You sometimes like break through ice with like little currents running below, and just like the cold really wears at you. You know, you don't get that in the gym. You're having to navigate every step, because if you miss a step, like you could snap an ankle, and it's a really long hobble to where a plane could ever pick you up, you know? So just having to think about like putting yourself in a position where you got to figure this out, you know? It was very different and enlightening, I would say.
Yeah. Were there any moments where you felt really vulnerable, either because of like an environmental challenge with the weather or being in the vicinity of some dangerous animals, where even if you have, you know, some weapons, I mean, if there's a bunch of them, you know, you're messing with nature, like any moments of vulnerability?
Yeah, we definitely had a few. I mean, every day something would happen where you're like, yeah, we're pretty alone out here. Because we were 100 some odd miles from the nearest town. And the town was like 1,000 people. And so a couple come to mind. So after I killed the caribou, we had to pack it out. So my pack was probably about 100 pounds, and we had like 5-6 miles all uphill of tundra to get back to camp. And this isn't a choice where you can go like, you know, if you're at the gym, you can be like, well, this sucks, I think I'm going to quit. Like, you can't tap out there. Because nothing's going to come get you. So just that, where you're like, it was the most physically difficult thing I've ever done, because it was like the intensity of a really like quick, nasty CrossFit workout combined with like the length of a 50-mile run or something. You know, it's right. Just, God, when is this going to
start? It's just like hours of suck.
Hours of suck. I mean, we had nights where like wolverines would come into camp, you know, and, you know, I would ask Donnie, I'm like, so are they pretty dangerous? He goes, well, if it comes to your tent, it's going to rearrange your face. It's like, oh my God.
Like, would you guys have to keep somebody up for security, or just go to sleep and hope that nothing mauls you in the middle of the night?
Yeah, go to sleep. And like, I mean, I slept like a rock out there, but the guys I was with were pretty in tune. They would hear stuff. Trying to think what else. We had one day where it was like negative 20, and we had a river crossing. And so we get out of this river, and it's like my boots instantly freeze up. And then we have this like trek across this frozen swamp. So like every now and then your boot would fall down in the swamp, and you bring up more water and it would freeze. And it was just unbelievably cold. And it was like, we ended up hiking like 12 miles out from camp. And then you have to come back, you know, and hopefully by before nightfall. And it's just so unbelievably cold the whole time that it just adds this crazy layer of stress that you could just never anticipate before getting there. You know, so it's like you kind of have to, as someone put it to me, like you got to figure out your shit, you know, more or less, if you're going to get through it. So it was definitely great. I mean, I think it did a lot for me, like psychologically, and just sort of understanding like what you're capable of, more or less. You know, if you get put in a position like that, like humans are pretty good at actually doing something. It sounds scary as hell before you do it, but if you once you do it, you're like, oh, if I can do that, what else could I do?
Yeah,
you know.
Totally.
So, yeah.
Did you guys procure food along the way, or did you bring enough rations for the entire trip initially, and just kind of, you know, store it somewhere?
Yeah, so we brought enough for the entire trip because we had sort of two trips. So we would bring enough for both and pack them around. And we kept it pretty light. And, you know, we weren't packing in the amount of calories that we were burning. But brought maybe, I would say, like 2,000 a day, but we're definitely going through more than that. So
you lose a lot of weight?
10 pounds. So I went in like a buck 70 and left like 160. I'm like 60. Okay. So I was pretty skinny coming out. But when we did end up killing a caribou, it was like, then you feast. Like, it's just, you know, start to get like that weird hunger obsession. Once your body like is really losing weight, like these, you know, these mechanisms that we've developed over time kick in and you just start to like obsess over food. And so then it's like cramming it in, you know, after we killed the caribou. So it was,
I would imagine that you did like quite a bit of hunting while you were hungry and food deprived, right? So everything, you know, in the sports world, it's like, well, you have to fuel for the game, but it's like, in reality, most of human history, people were hungry when they were procuring food and had to perform. So but it seems like you adapted to it.
Yeah, definitely adapted. I mean, it's funny, right? Because we have like complicated training programs and nutrition plans and whatever. And it's like early humans would run 25 miles doing a persistence hunt and they didn't have any of that stuff. But what they did have was hunger, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, we can figure stuff out.
By the end of the trip, did you feel competent to the point that like you could hunt on your own, procure your own food without the help of like the guys that you have or you had?
I think so. Yeah. So we had, I mean, the guy I went with, for listeners who don't know him, his name's Donnie Vincent and he's a backcountry hunter. He also does some documentaries. Check him out. It's just Google his name. It's Donnie Vincent. And, so I went with him and he's had a ton of experience in the wild. So he was able to, you know, help me a lot. But I think with caribou, I could hunt them at this point. You know, it's sort of, I picked up a lot from Donnie for sure. We also did a doll sheep hunt. That's a little tricky because they tend to live up in cliffs and that's essentially their defense mechanism. They just go where no other animal can. In fact, the animal that tends to do decently well hunting them are big birds because they'll just dive bomb down and push a doll sheep off a cliff and then go pick at its remains. So, I mean, pretty crazy animals. So that one was tricky. We didn't end up getting a doll sheep on that hunt just because they're really freaking hard to hunt. And Donnie was hunting them with a bow hunt, with a bow. So
was the team pretty patient with you? Did they look at you as like kind of someone who was going to jeopardize the expedition or did they kind of mentor you and were they, you know, treat you as one of their own?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I definitely felt treated like I was one of my own. They did tell me at a certain point, they were like, you're doing better out here than we expected.
You know? That's good to hear, better than the other way. Yeah.
I just kind of like, you know, I tried to control what variables I could going in. It was like, okay, I'm going to make sure I'm as fit as I can be. I'm going to get the right gear and I'm not going to complain and I'm just going to do what I need to do. And if I can just do that, I should be fine, you know? And I felt like that's what happened. So,
I mean, I'm sure after a trip like that, a warm bed and, you know, better access to food is a nice change, but was there almost like a letdown when you came back? Like now you've got to go back to regular life after hunting caribou and, you know, in the mountains of Alaska.
Yeah, dude. Cause like everything changes, right? It's like, there was one time when I was out there and I went out on the tundra early one morning and it's so unbelievably silent out there. And so you stand there for a minute and you start to hear something and you realize it's your heart beating. And you can hear your lungs, like the inner workings of your lungs. And like, you can hear your joints creak and it's just so quiet. And once we left, we stayed at a airport in Anchorage before flying home. And I walked into my hotel room and it was a hotel by the airport and there's a plane taking off right as I walk in. And it was so unbelievably loud just because my hearing had kind of adapted to these really loud things. And it was just like, whoa, welcome back. But then everyday life, it's like up there, you kind of have one goal, right? We're going to hunt today. That's what we're going to do every day. And we're just going to do that. Whereas when you get home, it's like, oh, I got to do X, Y, Z, you know, and it just, things kind of change. You get a little more frenetic. It's like, that scene at the end of what's that movie? The Hurt Locker with Jeremy.
Yeah. In the supermarket. Yeah.
He's in the supermarket and he's just kind of like absentmindedly staring into like the shelves and just kind of turns and he's like back. You kind of have a little bit of that. I mean, I don't know if you experience that like with your own stuff that you do, but I definitely had those moments.
Yeah. I mean, there's times where you're like, I'm never going to be as cool as I was, you know? But how nice was it to not like look at your phone? Because to me, the phone thing and email, it's like, it's afforded us a lot of convenience and accessibility, but I almost feel like I'm too accessible now. And the barrier to communicate with somebody is so low that like anybody that wants a piece of you can get a piece of you. Whereas before you had to like pick up a phone and call somebody and that would deter people from, it took some effort. Now, you know, it's like, I just remember even before Waze and Google Maps, like I always found my way. I always could get to places, maybe with a little bit more effort. I always like met up with my friends, even without being able to text them. Like, it's nice to have those things, but I can only imagine how refreshing it probably was for at least for a couple of weeks to like not have your phone buzzing every 2 seconds.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those things take so much of our attention. Like I teach at UNLV, and in one of my classes, I had them all look at their screen times, my students, and these are college students. And, some people were like at 7-something hours and 8 hours. It's just like, just spending more time on those things. And I do think we're losing a lot from it. Like, I definitely think there's some trade-offs. In fact, there's a whole section in the book about boredom, how we've lost boredom. And I'm sort of interpreting it through this idea that we don't really allow our minds to wander anymore. Because anytime we feel this discomfort of boredom, we grab our phones. Whereas we used to go inward. Now our attention is always outward facing, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, even it's this idea like that we have to be hyper efficient all the time and things that used to be opportunities for social interaction and communication, like even preparing a meal, like now we look at that as it's a burden to have to cook a meal. But like when you cook a meal, you're spending time with somebody, you're kind of detaching yourself from work and stress and stuff like that. Cause it's kind of a very almost like therapeutically monotonous activity. You cut the food, you turn the stove on, you're talking to somebody, listen to some music. It's like very light and like you're not in a rush. And now it's like we've vilified free time. And now you have to, well, like now we can get food delivered. Like I'm in New York. I mean, it's a little bit weirder now with a lot of restaurants being closed. But before this pandemic, it's like you can get food delivered at any time of the day. You go on your phone, it's super easy. So instead of preparing food, you're like, how can I be busy between now and when the food gets delivered? And, you know, it's, yeah, like you said, there's a downside to being too, you can be too efficient to the point that I think it's not good for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like you hear, especially out of Silicon Valley, you hear a lot about like this mindset of like, we always have to grind and like, you know, work is going to save you or whatever. And it's just like, that is a false hope.
Yeah. It's killing a lot of people.
Absolutely is. And it's just like, I feel like these things tether you to always have the ability to work. And I don't think that's a good thing. And I see it in myself. I have a really hard time shutting that off.
Yeah.
Really hard. But when I'm able to, that I think is the benefit of like doing cool outdoor things. Go somewhere where your cell phone doesn't get reception because it's awesome.
Yeah. You don't have a choice there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that thing. Yeah, the thing was never going to work out there. It was basically just like a crappy camera every now and then.
What's the name of the book? And I know that you're just starting the publication process. Any idea, is there a final title or when it's going to be released? Just so people can kind of keep it on the radar.
Yeah, it's called The Comfort Crisis. And it will
love that title.
Yeah, it's good. It was my editor thought it up. I wasn't sold on it at first, but when I tell it to people, they're like, oh, I get it, you know?
Yeah.
And it'll be out in April of 2021. I don't know exactly what, but
so your part's done. It's out of your hands now.
More or less. I mean, I'm still going to have to do some stuff on it. We'll have a little bit of back and forth, but it's 98% there. And then they'll have to, you know, I'll have to do some of the marketing stuff. So
it's gotta be a relief.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird. Like after I turned it in, like the final, it's just, I walked around the house, like almost like, what do I do with myself now? I felt kind of just like lost, you know, just cause it's a lot of work. It's like 9 hours a day for 365 days, more or less, you know, so.
Cool. Where can people follow you to get updates on, you know, like articles you write and when the book finally comes out, as far as like social media or website, stuff like that?
For sure. So you can find, my website is eastermichael.com. I have a newsletter. It was put on hiatus as I sort of finished my book, but that should be starting up again soon. You can sign up on my website there. And then I'm on Instagram. I'm also on Twitter, but I mainly just lurk there and look for information from smart people like Doug, and also sort of watch the crazy wars in fitness and nutrition that happen from the sidelines. And
such. Watch the world burn.
watch it all burn, man.
Cool. Thanks for your time. And, you know, we'll have to talk to you maybe like, you know, in April when the book comes out and get to more depth than that.
Yeah, I'm in.
Look forward to reading it.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Resilient Performance Podcast. As a thank you for listening, we'd like to offer a 10% discount on our online products, which you can find at resilientperformance.com. We'd like you to use the promo code PODCAST, PODCAST, to get the 10% off. Right now we have the Resilient Movement Foundations course online format for you to purchase there. And we hope to grow that soon before the end of the year and have some other offerings. We hope you enjoy. Again, that's promo code PODCAST, PODCAST, for 10% off. Thanks.